The same divine self is the life of every living creature, and the love animals feel is nothing but the unconscious striving to achieve the unity of the self on the lowest, physical plane of consciousness. A child going through the phase of awakening consciousness also tries involuntarily to achieve this same unity and identity by putting into its mouth everything it can get its little hands on. Animals have the same instinct. The unity and the love between me and my lions is so great that they like to tuck my hand or even my head between their jaws as if they were going to eat me. Naturally, they don't bite, and their play is not to be taken seriously. I can understand that when they eat a gazelle, for example, they are only following out their instinctive striving for unity. The instinct for self-preservation has the same source as the instinct for the preservation of a species, striving for the divine state of unity. That's why the manifestations of both instincts are so close together and often overlap. Nature exploits this primordial tendency towards unity in order to create progeny through the instinct for procreation and propagation of the species and in order to preserve the body through the satisfaction of hunger. This is the reason why the meat lions get from their keepers never tastes as good as the flesh they tear from the body of fresh killed prey, for in this latter act they are unconsciously experiencing a form of union with the living, with life itself. With dead flesh they can satisfy only their hunger but not their subconscious striving toward union. I get a great deal of pleasure out of spending time with my lions. It's thrilling to observe how these majestic animals manifest all the characteristics of the divine Ra, the sun, transformed to the animal level. Little Buga, too, shares my pleasure in the lions, just as he is in harmony with me in everything I do or say. How well I remember the endless patience my father exhibited when he taught me how to stand up in a chariot speeding over uneven ground. It's my turn now to teach the same techniques to Boga. He's very skillful, instinctively making the right movements, and after a short time he is able to accompany me even on long rides. During quieter periods, father and I withdraw to our little holiday house on the seashore. Boga comes with us, and the three of us enjoy the pleasures of sun and sand and water. Father too likes to spend time with the little boy, and we find it thrilling to watch his pure soul develop like a magnificent flower. Once, after watching Boga for quite a while, father calls and asks him to come over close. As soon as Boga is near enough for quiet conversation, father asks him, "Well, Boga, would you like to work with me?" Boga prostrates himself before father, and with his hands together as a sign of profoundest respect, he replies, "Master, I'll devote my whole life to the task you give me in order to be worthy of it." Father pats the boy's head. "Stand up, Boga," he says, "you will work with us in the great task of redeeming the earth. Just do what your teachers in the temple tell you, and one day you will be echo worker with us. Stand up. You don't need to throw yourself on the ground before me." Boga can't contain his joy. And he jumps around like a little monkey. Then he tries to be dignified like a grown-up worthy of father's confidence. Finally he runs down to the seashore to look for mussels. When I'm alone with father, I ask him, "Father, now that I've been initiated, when I raise myself above the level of time, I can look into the past and the future the same as you, but I still can't recognize anything in my own future. Why is that?" "The only importance I attach to the future is the development it will bring me in my progress up to the last, highest, divine degree. But please explain to me why I can see everybody else's future but my own. I see only mist before my eyes when I turn my consciousness towards my own future." Father looks at me, smiles and waits. I smile back and answer him in thought. We understand each other. His look tells me, "What are you asking for? If you don't see your future, it simply means that's the way it's meant to be so you can fulfill your task properly. Don't bother about it, but do everything to attain by your own efforts the highest degree you reached with Tahotep's help during your initiation. When our tasks call us back to the city, the days go by as in the past, and I spend some of my time in the temple and some in the palace. I love my work. It satisfies me completely. Nevertheless, all day long I go about with the joyful anticipation of being able to withdraw into myself, into God, when my day's duties are over. Every time I turn inward with the determination to reach the highest degree by my own efforts, and I actually do come nearer and nearer to perfect fulfillment. Yet every time I return to my personal consciousness, I get up disappointed. Once again I realize I have failed to achieve the last and highest reality which I experienced in my initiation and which burns in my memory like an unquenchable flame. My only consolation in such moments is that of looking forward to participating in Vesper prayers and meditations with Tahotep. Tahotep, his deputy, the priests and priestesses, initiates all, meet in the temple at sunset. We sit in a circle, with Tahotep and his deputy sitting diametrically opposite each other and thus forming two poles. All the rest of us form two semicircles on either side. It takes us a while to free our spiritual body from impurities which we have unavoidably absorbed during our contacts with the sons of men. Then Tahotep extends his blessed hands to his neighbors on either side. All the rest of us join hands too, thus forming a circuit through which Tahotep and his deputy conduct a current of the highest, supreme, divine degree into our bodies. This helps us experience the supreme state of divine unity. In this way our nerves develop resistance much faster than they would if we were dependent only on our own energies. These moments of bliss, experienced daily during our evening prayers, give meaning and content to my whole life. O God! Give me the strength to reach you with my consciousness by my own efforts. We will meet again. One day the court is making ready to celebrate a great reception. Some time ago Father sent his commander, Thistha, together with many notables, a large number of troops, and ships full of presents and goods for barter, as an emissary to a far country. The ruler there received our dignitaries very cordially and soon thereafter sent his own troops bearing presents and goods for barter to our country. Today we are going to celebrate the arrival of these foreign troops. Menu decks me out in my most beautiful dress, and with the usual ceremonies, Ruka brings me the queen's jewels. Then the two elders escort me to Father, and we walk through the long colonnades accompanied by the whole court. In this manner we walk out in a column onto the terrace before the palace. In his full dignity and great beauty, the pharaoh takes his place on his golden throne in the middle of the terrace. To his right is his audience lion, while I take my seat to his left and a bit out in front, almost at the edge of the terrace. The people of rank take their proper places to our right and left according to their degree and station. Then the great reception begins. The troops of the foreign power march up in a long festive procession. Their leader and his retinue step up before the terrace and bow down before us with outstretched arms. Then their leader makes a fine speech in our language to tell us how eager his ruler is to reach a long-term alliance with us. Then he calls his porters forward to bring us our gifts. I observe the changing scene from above and look at the men in the leader's retinue. All of splendid physique. They wear their ceremonial robes and military armor. The strangers are big, strong, broad-shouldered and very muscular men. In our country only the descendants of the race of the sons of God are as tall and strong as these strange soldiers, but much more slender, nimble and resilient. Tahotep, Father and some of the other descendants of the sons of God like Ima, Mentupta, Imhotep and some priestesses have beautiful and powerful bodies, but they are majestic, dignified, full of spirituality. Less robust, they don't look so much like splendid animals. Never before in my life have I seen people like these strangers. They don't please me at all. In our country I am accustomed to seeing finely chiseled facial features that reflect spirituality, especially among the descendants of the race of the sons of God, and even among the hybrid race. These strangers have irregular features that make them look like animals. Especially their ears. Our ears are small, narrow and finely chiseled with the lobes separate from the side of the neck. These strangers have big, broad ears, Their lobes join to their necks like those of monkeys. And what strikes us all as particularly strange is their red hair. Their faces, hands, arms and feet are covered with an abundance of hair, shining like golden threads in the sunshine. They are self-assured, and when they talk or laugh they reveal rows of beautiful, white, glistening, strong teeth. But this feature too makes me think of animals. They radiate great strength, but not spiritual strength. No. I don't like their looks. I can see our guests from abroad find us just as strange as we think they are. They don't like our looks either. I see their eyes have not yet been opened to the spirit. They are unable to appreciate, or even to perceive any fine, delicate, spiritualized shapes. They see only the people of our country as smaller than they. Reading their thoughts, I can see they hold us in contempt. I am accustomed to seeing the fire of admiration kindled in the eyes of men when they look at me. These strangers admire my robe and my jewels without noticing at all that I am beautiful. I can see very well that they're curious about me, the queen of this country, and they stare at me at every opportunity without noticing that I am beautiful. Yes, I know I inherited my mother's small stature, but a woman's beauty does not depend on her size. But these men, these strange warriors from a far-off country think a woman has to be big and fleshy to be beautiful. I observe myself as I always do. Have feelings of vanity sprung up within me? No. Far from it. I am merely displeased because they are so ignorant, immature and crude, like people in the lowest class of the sons of men in our country. All these people are so lacking in culture and polish, including their leaders and the people of rank accompanying them. One of them is standing in front of the terrace, right in front of me. He must be a high officer because he has come forward in the closest proximity to their commander. Now he's standing amidst a group of soldiers and staring at me incessantly. The corners of his mouth show a disrespectful attitude. The way he acts really doesn't befit a person of rank. How can a man stare at a woman so impertinently? In all our court only Rook is as impertinent as this fellow, and even he can't conceal his admiration for my beauty. But this stranger merely stares insolently without the slightest admiration. Nevertheless, I fight down any and all feelings of vanity within myself. I watch out and keep myself under constant control. I turn away to watch the ceremonies again. Fascinated by the military games these soldiers are playing, I must admit they possess physical strength unknown in our country. Their race is descended from a half-blooded son of God who manifested his father's high divine power in his blood, instead of his spirit, and so became a giant. His descendants intermarried with primitive people and developed a big-boned race with enormous muscular strength. They're not nearly so agile and adroit as our warriors, but they can perform feats of strength that would be beyond the ability of our soldiers. During these military games I glance down once in a while at the insolent foreigner in front of me. He is still staring at me untiringly. Actually, it would be a truly inspiring task to guide such an uncultured, red-headed stranger into the mysteries of the spirit. To help him step by step to open his inner eyes. To enable him to see the beauty of a woman's spirituality instead of only her flesh. For several days I am so preoccupied with our guests from abroad that I have no time to go to the temple. Feasts and ceremonies follow each other in rapid succession. Exhibitions, excursions and banquets, and at all of these events it is my duty to take my place beside my father in officiating as host and hostess. Menu is in her element, clothing me in ever more beautiful, ever more magnificent robes. Boga, however, is embittered and saddened because I have no time for him. Ruka comes frequently with his jewel bearers to bring me new creations of the jeweler's art. I go through with all this because it's my duty to do so. Nevertheless, I look at my image in my great silver mirror with eager curiosity, wondering what the foreigner from abroad will have to say about my new robe or my new jewels. Especially when father and I and all the court once dress up after the fashion of our guests from abroad in order to show our friendly attitude towards them. I really have to laugh to see how odd Father looks in this strange costume. And I? Won't our red-headed guests from abroad find me beautiful even in these clothes? For by this time I have got acquainted with him. Father introduced me to his commander and all the ranking officers, including him, and now I find myself in the company of these emissaries from abroad every day. Their country's ruler, in preparing for this expedition, selected only men who had succeeded in learning our language in a very short time. Thus we are able to converse very pleasantly with our guests and exchange ideas with them. But I find myself ill at case in the presence of this strange guest from abroad who stared at me so insolently throughout all the reception ceremony. And my heart beats faster when I realize he has exactly the same voice as the man who turned into a flaming spirit in my initiation dream. How strange! These strangers are peculiar people, lacking in culture and learning but not stupid at all. They live very close to nature. And even though they don't intellectually know the inner, creative laws and the essence of things, they know a lot as a result of their own direct experiences. It is remarkable to observe how a truth, which we clearly see and know in our spirit through inner contemplation, appears in these people as mere belief and superstition. When they don't know the source and cause of a force, they imagine that it comes from an invisible being, and they then give the name God to their own imaginings. And they stubbornly insist on calling these imaginary, fairy-talc creatures gods. They think they know everything better. When one tries to tell them the truth and explain real facts to them, they merely shake their head and laugh condescendingly. Of course, I am not permitted to tell them any of the secrets of the temple, but still I have tried to explain to our foreign guest the forces which cause lightning and thunder in a storm. I knew I wouldn't be permitted to tell him how the high priest uses the Ark of the Covenant in the pyramid to create lightning and the blessed rain that keeps our country from becoming absolutely barren. But I did try to explain to him that lightning comes from a meeting of two opposite forces and that he can cause the same phenomenon himself by striking two pieces of stone together. At this he gave me a supercilious look, saying he knew very well that lightning was the arrow of the chief god, and that little demons live in certain stones and become angry and shoot out little flashes of lightning whenever they're disturbed. When I tried to give him the true explanation of this phenomenon, I found his mind closed up tight. In one sense, it doesn't make any difference whether we consider lightning to be the arrow of the chief god or the meeting of positive and negative forces. But if these people continue to believe in their superstitions and all their various imaginary gods, they'll never learn to control the forces of nature and always remain slaves of their superstition. Anyway, I have succeeded in getting our strange red-headed officer guest interested enough in my explanations of various natural phenomena so that he's always eager to hear more. He said he would like to have me teach him, so he's going to come to the temple every day, and I will initiate him into the lowest degree of knowledge. After sunset, Menu helps me into my priestess robes. Then, heavily veiled, we both walk over to the temple. A neophyte has accompanied our officer guest to my little cell in the temple wall where he is awaiting me. Menu stays behind in the temple court, and I enter my cell. The stranger is already there. Standing there, leaning against the wall of my cell, he greets me with his usual smile of superiority. This smile annoys me. How does he dare to look at me this way? He's not my superior in any respect. Just because he's physically bigger and stronger, he ignorantly assumes himself to be superior in every way. He doesn't have the faintest idea that the power of mind stands over everything. But I'm going to show him. With the power of my mind, I'm going to conquer this insolent, red-headed giant. Despite all his physical power, he'll be vanquished, and through my spiritual power I'll come out victorious. The stranger bows deeply, but I see clearly he's doing it without conviction. Here in our country the people practically worship me. They know I am an initiated priestess, a servant of God. The stranger also knows I am a priestess in the temple, but he doesn't know what initiation means. He doesn't know that our knowledge is not a system of beliefs based merely on human imaginings, but rather the direct recognition of truth. Divine omniscience. But I'll open his eyes. I'll explain the mystery of man and the universe to him. I'll guide him into the mystery of all creation. If you want to achieve true knowledge, I tell him, you must first learn to know yourself. You have to know what you yourself are. When you come to know yourself, you will discover that all the truths of the universe are concealed within your own being. Thus D.H. Ruff, this self-recognition you will get to know all the secrets of the world. First solve the great puzzle of our Sphinx, that of man himself. You must recognize what you are. The stranger looks at me attentively at first, but then begins to smile. I'm supposed to learn what I am? I've known that for a long time. Why is that supposed to be such a great mystery? But it seems to me, O Queen, that you don't know what I am, and so I am telling you, I am a man. And with that he lets out a hearty laugh, showing all his big white teeth. Oh my! What a child he is! His laugh is so infectious that I can't help laughing myself. I know very well that you're a man. I answer him. But I can't even finish my sentence because the red-haired giant interrupts me impolitely. It seems to me, Queen, that you not only don't know I'm a man, but that you don't even know what a man is. I'm not a priest and can't read people's thoughts the way you can, but I know women, and I can see something you don't know at all, or else you've forgotten it, and that is what you are. You don't know you're a woman. How do you think you can try to teach me the inner secrets of man and the universe if you don't even know this simple fact that everybody else can see? I know very well that I'm a woman, I reply with dignity. The stranger smiles insolently, but I continue undisturbed. The outer form is only the mantle of the inner being. When one knows the inner being and when one is the inner being, he uses the outer form only as an instrument but does not identify himself with it. The body is only the robe of the self. You wear clothing too, and yet you are not the clothing. In the very same way you wear a body which can be either male or female, but yourself stands above the sexes and is neither man nor woman. The self is the creator. The person, the physical, material manifestation is only one half of the true being. The other half has remained behind in the unconscious, unmanifested state. And whether a manifestation is male or female depends merely on which half has incarnated itself. When a person has made both halves of his being conscious and experienced them consciously, he has become identical with his self, and then he carries within himself both the male and female principles in complete equilibrium. But still his body is either male or female, isn't it? He asks. Yes, indeed. I answer. The material phenomenon can only be one-sided, for whenever the two sides merge into unity there is nothing physical. The union of the two complementary halves, the merging of the two sides would mean complete annihilation of matter, complete dematerialization of the body. One can only be androgynous in spirit. Queen, answers the guest from abroad, there's only one thing in all your pretty words that I can really understand quite clearly. A point on which I'm in complete agreement with your secrets, namely that my physical manifestation, as you express it so neatly, is only one half of a unit. In the past I have often sought, and found, a complementary half, but I was never annihilated in doing so. Perhaps because I never found the real unity. But even if it were to mean annihilation, I would go on seeking my true, complementary half. I am a man. And my other half can only be a woman who gives me complete and perfect happiness. For such a woman I would gladly lay down my life. I feel in my body a warm rush of blood that reaches my head. In the face of such a way of thinking I am completely powerless. How can I explain to him that the earthly happiness he is seeking in a woman is only transitory and unable to satisfy his immortal soul? We end our discussion for today. He must have time to digest the new truths I have given him. And there follow many evenings in which I do battle with his ignorance. I am determined to help him make progress, and I take all kinds of care to say the right words to him in order to fan the divine spark into flame and awaken his higher self. When I wake up in the morning, he is already in my thoughts. I remember everything we spoke about the previous evening and concentrate my thinking throughout the day on the lesson I am going to give him in the evening. Often during these days I race through the countryside with my lions, but now it's without Bogar. Bogar hangs his head as he goes to his master Ima for lessons. Ima tries to console him with all kinds of presents and everything else a boy's heart could wish for. I'm sorry to see Bogar so sad, but I need time to be alone with my own thoughts. After one of my chariot rides, while I'm taking leave of my lions in the lion's court, I pat their heads and run my fingers through their manes. As I'm doing this, it suddenly occurs to me that our officer guest from abroad has exactly the same color hair as the lion's. If I were to stroke his head, the same thick locks of red hair would be slipping through my ringers. Oh, how I love these lions! That evening I tell our guest my observation about his having the same color hair as the lion's. Queen, he says, may I go for a chariot ride with you sometime? If I could see that you could control real live lions with your willpower, I'd begin to believe in your superhuman powers. And he laughs tauntingly. Where have you heard that I have superhuman powers? Everybody I talk to adores you like a goddess. Everybody believes you're a supernal being. But I don't. I feel injured. What do you think about me? I ask, noticing with some annoyance that my heart is pounding while I await his answer. In the very same moment, quick as a flash, Tahotep's image pops up before my inward eye, with a warning expression on his noble face. No. No. Leave me alone, I answer the inward image. I'm in no danger. And outwardly I go on listening to what the stranger says. So you want to know what I think about you? Why do you want to hear that from me? If you're so high up above everything earthly, why should you be interested in what goes on in a poor earthly head like mine? And after all, you can read people's thoughts, can't you? Yes, I can read your thoughts, but I want to see whether you're being frank with me, I answer. But as I do so, I am aware of an uneasy feeling. There's no time to try to find out what this feeling means, because the stranger asks me again, so you want to know whether I'm being frank with you? Why don't you ask yourself first whether you're being frank with yourself? I am speechless. I just don't know what to answer. For years I've made a habit of self-observation in order to seek out the motives of all my thoughts and deeds. I am convinced I am frank with myself and therefore frank with the rest of the world, including him. Nevertheless, his words bring an embarrassing surprise. Could he be right? Have I really lacked the courage frankly to face all my thoughts and feelings? I resolve to examine myself even more thoroughly, but in any case I'm going to concentrate all my efforts in order not to be defeated in the struggle with him. I must come out victorious. I mustn't allow an uncouth stranger to think I'm weaker than he is. I mustn't allow him to think he stands above me. The next day we go for a chariot ride together. Before we get in, the stranger stands beside the lions and holds out his shaggy red head towards me. Want to try and see if my hair really feels like the lions? If they don't mind your stroking their hair, I may be able to stand it too, he says with a hearty laugh that erupts from between two perfect rows of white teeth. He really is a big child. He's not behaving this way out of lack of respect, and I can't be angry at him. I have to laugh too, and if the keeper of my lions were not standing near, I really would feel like tousling his hair. And so it goes, day after day. And the time quickly draws near when the stranger will have to return to his homeland. In many respects I could be satisfied. As a woman I could even gloat in triumph at the way his attitude has changed. He has put away his superior airs and waits all day long every day for the evening to come so that we can be together. I realize he never really felt superior, and that his overbearing manner was actually a kind of self-defense to save him from complete capitulation. He didn't want to give up his masculine arrogance. He admired me from the very first moment he saw me, and my vanity, which first drove me to spend time in his company, could now be completely satisfied. And yet I am not satisfied. On the contrary, I am plagued by persistent anxiety. But every time I analyze my feelings, this anxiety gives me the reassurance that my interest for him is not coming from the feminine instinct of my lower nature. For I am constantly watching and checking on myself.